All right, welcome back. Hour number two, and greetings to all of you around this ever more troubled world, in other countries, wherever you may be, and in many countries, like the Philippines comes to mind, but there are people dying all over the place from these shots, and as it was planned. These are bioweapons. These are not injections that are going to do any good for anybody. They're only harm. Harm. That's all they are, is bad news. And we're going to talk a little bit this hour about the iron-copper issue and blood clots. This is very interesting. And I know some of you have been following along and doing a good job at understanding what we've been talking about. We're going to go through that again tonight because copper, more and more, appears to be a main player in this whole soap opera of death, dying, and suffering. It's extraordinary. Will you find out? And there are people who are actually taking complementary supplements of copper on top of whatever else they're doing dietetically. You don't need to take any extra. Don't do that. Just keep your diet healthy. Stay on it. Think about what you're eating. Don't just grab a box or grab a frozen package. Read the labels. Hello there, young lady.
Hello.
So is copper the mineral of the year? Is that where we are now with this whole horrible COVID crisis? It's stepping up. It's not getting talked about as much as it might be or will be, but it's a critically important issue. And yet, again, there are too many critically important issues with this whole attack on humanity for most people to track. We understand that. But this copper iron thing is big. First of all, the spike protein attacks your red blood cells, right? Hemoglobin. It fragments the cell into two.
Heme and hemoglobin.
And the heme too. It basically fractures the blood cell into two parts, iron and heme. And they're both toxic unless they're bound to each other. And when they're bound to each other, it's the only time they can carry and deliver oxygen to every cell in your body. So the spike goes right after your blood in it immediately to destroy it. And by just wiping out the red blood cells, it couldn't start off on a more auspiciously dangerous course. It's deadly. I don't want to understate it. Okay, go ahead and let's see where we are on this. And then we got the iron issue to deal with, which again is part of that hemoglobin problem. Don't forget that. It's the cell-associated iron or cell-bound iron is one thing, but unbound iron is quite another. And that's hard for people to track.
Well, the same concept applies to copper because these are both what we call transition metals. They go through different states of oxidation. They can gain and lose electrons, which is good. This is how we perform oxidative reactions in the body. This is how we kill pathogens. This is how we detoxify. It's how we breathe. But they've got to be controlled. They need to be on some sort of a protein, some sort of a carrier, so that the body can control how they are used.
Right.
And when you're in a state of high inflammation, high oxidation,
Let me pause. The most important thing that most people don't understand is that this is an inflammatory highway to death and disability. Inflammation
Correct.
In your body is catastrophic with these bioweapons. Don't forget that. Another thing.
Yeah, the cytokine storm that can be lethal is all about inflammation. It's an out of control
right.
Response on the body trying to rid itself of this poison or pathogen,
right.
And in the process, it ends up damaging its own structures. And so, not only is iron dysregulated in this oxidative state, but also copper. Copper can dissociate from its carrier protein, which is ceruloplasmin, and then it becomes toxic, just like unbound iron, and can participate in a lot of unwanted oxidative reactions and start to damage
Well, it's like throwing gasoline on a inflammation fire.
Yeah, and you get on this merry-go-round of inflammation that feeds on itself, and you know, it's very difficult to stop. You begin to run out of your own antioxidants that would normally mm-hmm. control this process, mm-hmm. And then it just perpetuates. And so, yes, there's a big fan club now of people taking copper, and sometimes you need it. I mean, neither one of these metals can you live without. You
it's,
need
see,
iron,
it's not
you
an
need
either
copper.
Or. It's not an either
no,
or.
No, you need it, but they need to be yes. properly regulated, and that is the problem.
Yes, ma'am. Yep.
Now, a deficiency of copper can be utterly devastating for the nervous system. And
why does it copper attack the neurology? What's the deal? What's the
well?
Link?
It's the loss of the copper in the nervous system. Copper is performing a function like SOD, superoxide dismutase. So it's controlling or mitigating the production of free radicals and helping to regulate iron because iron is going back and forth, gaining or losing electrons, and copper is helping it to do that. And so when the copper is missing from the nervous system, you very quickly run into iron toxicity. And then the flip side of that is if you have too much copper in the nervous system, which is unbound, it can compete with iron for the sulfur clusters. And so you end up with iron toxicity that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a balancing act, and when I see people just willy-nilly thinking that these things on their own are going to solve their fatigue issues or whatever it is they're dealing with, they're really...
That's human nature. People want a simple answer. They want the magic bullet. They've been taught to think pills their whole lives for resolution of any unwanted situation. Take a pill. And that's their mentality. It's not their fault. All right, we've got a video here. We played about a week ago somebody named Greg Harrison and his presentation about white clots, amyloid clots, if you will, the white ones. We've got another video here. We can play just a few minutes of it if you want, and let me know when you want to start. You might want to go ahead and tell us who Harrison is, just to refresh people's
okay,
minds.
So this, we played, this is from Tony Lone's podcast. He's a Canadian who was kind enough to assemble these embalmers. John O'Looney was one last week, and we have Richard Hirschman, who everybody knows by now, and then Tom Haviland, who was the ex-military gentleman mm-hmm. who tried to interview or collect data from embalmers as to how many of them are actually witnessing these clots when they embalm their clients. And then we have this gentleman, Greg Harrison, from Australia, who happens to be a polymer chemist, and he has, you know, graciously extended his talents of analyzing these clots with his expertise. And he does make a point of saying that he's not a biochemist. He is a polymer chemist. So he knows his chemistry and, you know, what might be contributing to these clots. And, you know, I am the first to give them credit for publishing this information because no one else has done it. And so we might have some clues as to, you know, why they're happening. Right. And if there's any chance of doing anything about it other than physically removing them. My one criticism right now, right from the get-go...
Let me say one thing before you. It's not really a criticism. It's an observation. And what we do here is take our time. We don't jump on board with anything, no matter how promising it may sound, without doing our own due diligence, which Erica is superb at. So I would just call it an observation rather than a criticism. That's just me.
Well, it's all well and good to proceed down this road, but have we answered the question, are we seeing these types of clots in people who have received
big question.
The adenoviral vector vaccines, meaning Johnson & Johnson or J&J, Janssen, AZ. AstraZeneca, and Sputnik, If you were in some other country other than here, I think Sputnik was distributed in South America and, well, Russia, obviously. But, you know, that's also a gene transfection technology that was widely used. Canada had quite a bit of AZ, AstraZeneca, as did Australia, as did the UK. So I don't think it's out of the question that we, you know.
So they used the adenovirus as a transmission vector.
Yes.
Is what they did with those.
Yeah,
so
it delivers a set of instructions to whatever cell it happens to transfect to begin making the spike protein. Now,
rather than
that
the
one
mRNA
would have been mostly,
se.
It did not use lipid nanoparticles. Lipid nanoparticles were used for Moderna and Pfizer.
Right.
It's mRNA. Adenovirus was a DNA virus, so it goes into the nucleus and creates the mRNA there, and then from which point the protein is produced. Now, I don't know what the distribution was for those adenoviral vectored vaccine. Probably most of it ended up in the liver, but there are receptors for the adenovirus throughout the body, including the endothelium, so it's possible that some of the endothelial cells could have been transfected with
it. I would say probable, yeah.
But, you know, there's a lid on that now. And, granted, Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca have been removed from the market, but there's still, you know, a significant number of people who did receive those vaccines. And,
millions,
you know,
it
begs the question, are they having this problem with these so-called embalmers clots also?
Right. Okay. We'll listen to a little bit of this video and come back with a little more commentary. This is a bit scientific. So you're certainly welcome to listen to the program as much as you'd like. Send it around to anybody you think might want to hear it in the science community and elsewhere. We know a lot of people in that particular realm are listening and paying attention. So we're very glad about that. And here's a little bit of the video of the part two of this embalmers convention. We'll call it that for fun. All right, here we go.
Speech Bulletin Podcast. It could be morning if you're in Nova Scotia and Ohio and Richard, help me with your place there.
Alabama.
But if you're in Australia, it's not after 9 p.m. So welcome to the podcast, Tom, Greg, Richard, and glad to have you. I got just one question and I'm going to hand it over to Tom. And you guys can individually answer it. We're talking about these white clots. And the funeral embalmers said they'd never, ever seen it before. Is it earthly? Where's it from? And I know Greg is going into detail about it, but is it from Earth? And where's it from? It's a good question. We should really know how these are happening. Anyway, I will keep quiet and pass it over to Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd
like to go ahead and start answer that one first, if I may, because I totally understand.
This is Hirschman talking.
Tony, where you're coming from, I've had so many people say that these are parasites, that these are, maybe not earthly, but some kind of a foreign alien entity.
That is actually true. He's kind of laughing at it, but it's being pushed around that these amyloid white clots, we call them amyloid clots, are some kind of off-planet invading organism or some kind of parasite. No. But that's true. He's making a good point.
In humanity and all that stuff. And I know all that sounds really wild and crazy, but I believe the answer is no, it is not. This is a pathological issue that's going on that's being caused by something. And, of course, we believe that we know what it is. But it is not a parasite. It's not a parasite as far as we can tell. I've had numerous researchers, doctors, scientists that have looked at these things directly. And every one of them have told me these are not parasites. If it were, I would be willing to bet one of them would have said so. So I do not believe they're parasites at all. So I think it's dangerous to go down that path, you know, getting people to think about these as some kind of foreign. I mean, they're a foreign entity as far as something that we've never seen. That part I get, but they're not like alive. So I'll leave it at that and let maybe Greg expound on that one a little bit as a scientific person and background.
All right. Greg Harrison is the one we featured a week or so ago. So he's back. Here he is.
Well, before we get started there, Richard, I want to go ahead and, first of all, you've got a spectacular specimen that you just recently took out of a corpse. Can you show the audience that spectacular specimen you just took out of a corpse?
Sure. It's in this tube right here. I'll bring this a little bit closer so that people can see, just to give you an idea what it looks like. And again, you can see dark spots.
Those all right, he's got a round glass tube with a long white clot in it, an amyloid-type
really
clot.
Really long.
Yeah, it's got to be 3 feet. And there are dark spots in it, as he just said, which sometimes you see, sometimes I've not seen that many that I can remember. It's about 3 feet long. It's definitely a big one. All right.
It is 20 inches, which is basically
20 inches
from my armpit to my wrist. But in where I removed this clot from was from the iliac artery, which is down in the groin area, and it was going up towards the heart. Now, understand there's a lot of twists and turns and stuff like that inside of the vascular system. So even though, you know, laid out in a long line like that, it's 20 inches, but inside of the body, it may not have, you know, seemed quite as long. But yeah, that's that clot was about 19 inches long. The poor individual that it was in had clots in every artery that I had to raise, which I, on that one, he was so bad that it was a 6-point injection. And I found clots, not necessarily to that size, but some smaller ones similar to this right here.
All right. That looked 3 feet long to me. I guess he's going to stick with 20 inches, but it looked longer. At any rate, he said that there were clots throughout this individual, as you just heard. And a 6-point injection, I would assume that's an embalming procedure to try to get formaldehyde in, but you can't when all the plumbing is plugged up with these clots. And that's what he's discussing now. We'll get to Greg Harrison in just a minute.
In his carotid arteries, in his axillary brachial arteries, and in the veins, the exact same white fibrous material. But this was a very large one that I don't necessarily see so often, but it doesn't mean it's not in the body. It's just I happened to be able to get a hold of this, and it came out in one piece. So,
thanks, Richard. Yeah, you know, Richard and myself and John O'Looney, when these things started happening, I've got, you know, a sample that Richard gave to me as well. We've never thought that they were alien or, you know, unearthly. We've always thought that they were some kind of bizarre chemical process going on in the body that's creating these things. And so when we've been doing our interviews, you know, we've been concentrating on the embalmers seeing the clots, you know, that they are indeed seeing them, the timing of when they saw them, you know, when they first started, and most of the embalmers said they first started in the year 2021, and then also the prevalence of them. We've been concerned about that because it's been such a high percentage. In the year 2022, the embalmers on average in the survey that I did that year said they were seeing these white fibrous clots in 30% of their corpses on average, and that's including all the embalmers that said they saw none. It's still an average of 30%. This last year went down to 20%. And that's not necessarily a vindication of the vaccine because most people took their vaccines way back in 2021. So you might expect the percentage of white fibrous clots in corpses to go down as you get further and further away from most people taking their last jabs way back in 2021. But one of the questions we commonly get asked is, what are these clots made of? Why or how are they forming? And that's what we're here today to really talk about, to have Greg answer for us from a polymer chemistry angle, how or why these clots are forming. So, but before we do that, I'd like to just take the audience real quickly through the normal clotting process, because something abnormal obviously is going on here to create the clots the size of what Richard just showed you in that long tube. So in the normal clotting process, whenever we get a cut on our skin, or maybe if we get like a spike protein from a certain vaccine in your bloodstream, it starts to create damage of what's called the endothelial lining. It's a thin single layer of cells that lines the inside of all our blood vessels. And whenever that single layer of cells on the inside of our blood vessels gets damaged, it starts to trigger the normal clotting process. So aggregate platelets, which are colorless blood cells, start to aggregate. It triggers a response for those platelets to aggregate. And it also triggers conversion of another natural substance that we have in our blood called fibrinogen. It's a protein, and it triggers the conversion of that from a liquid state into a solid state, which is colored white, called fibrin. And it creates these fibrin strands that then go and they almost form like a lattice work that then can help strengthen the aggregation of the platelets that were formed at the site of the injury. So that makes the clot a lot tougher and more durable while the healing process is going on. Once the healing process is almost complete, then there's other proteins in your body that actually help stop the process of clotting, because you don't want to get a cut in your skin and then have a clot form that, you know, totally goes up your arm and starts to clot the blood all the way up your arm. So there's other proteins that actually stop that process. And then the clot eventually dissolves when your the vascular wall is healed and everything's back to normal again. And this fibrinogen that we have in our system, it's produced by the liver. And there's typically about 2 to 4 grams per liter of fibrinogen that's in normal blood. And if you think about what a gram, like a paperclip weighs a gram, a raisin weighs a gram, a stick of gum weighs about a gram. So think about it in those terms. We have about 6 liters of blood that are in our body. So if you go with the high end of 4 grams per liter of fibrinogen, 4 times 6 would be 24. That would be 24 grams of this fibrinogen as kind of a high in a normal adult average person's blood total. The fibrinogen, I've seen papers in the past where fibrinogen levels have been up as high as like 8.8. And whenever the fibrinogen level in the human blood gets past a certain point, the concentration gets higher than 7, it's deemed very high. And it's deemed as making that person very likely to develop blood clots. So there's a danger level if the body has too much fibrinogen in it. This is normally. So,
okay, you want to jump ahead to Greg Harrison? He's taking a little longer than I thought to get there. That's a good explanation that we just heard. It makes sense. Easy to understand. We can jump ahead.
Yeah, you can. I'll warn you, it is very technical. But he does lay out a very well-documented explanation of how he thinks these things are forming. And you know, it's he has all the supportive documentation to make this contention. It's up to you if you want to play any of that.
All right. Well, I've certainly mentioned him several times, so we should give him a little air time here. We'll give him a couple minutes here so you can hear. You'll remember, I think, when you heard the last little excerpt we played from the first get-together of these people, or most of the same people, except for John O'Looney. All right, here's Greg, I think.
So at this point, I'd like to hand it over to Greg to explain to him why that's happening and how he thinks the COVID-19 vaccines are involved in that process, both the spike protein and the lipid nanoparticle that the mRNA from the vaccine is encased in that gets it into all the cells in our body. So, Greg, take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. It's a very accurate assessment, and you've pretty much touched on most of the formation pathways that are occurring to form these white clots. However, it's a little more complex than that, and it's to the point that I'd like to open up a presentation we prepared for the medical fraternity and skip through it, because this presentation is over 100 slides long and it'll just put everyone to sleep. So I suggest I go to some of the slides that'll actually expand upon on what Tom is saying. So if you please allow me to share my screen.
You can share, Greg. You go ahead.
Yep. And I do apologize if this does cure your insomnia, but we have to start off with some basic chemistry to understand what we found. First of all, myself and my colleagues who have done this work, we are not medically qualified and we are not biochemists. Yes, I did some biochemistry in my early days as I branched off into organic chemistry, but I spent my life in organic polymer chemistry. I ran a polymer additives chemical manufacturing company. I understand implicitly the polymerization pathways that occur with industrial polymers. And surprisingly, I had no idea about the existence of white clots. But one day, I happened to be watching the Epoch Times, and up came an analysis that piqued my interest. Because I was involved in the chemical industry for so many years, we used to design our products around...
Okay, that is going to dive in. I see where he's going now. It's going to get to be a little sticky. But the point here is that these white clots are most unusual, and they are horrific. They can grow anywhere in the body, and apparently do. Remember, embalmers don't look at every vein, every artery, to see if there are clots growing in there. They'll see them when they're trying to put in embalming fluid. They can see where the blockages are and figure it out, but they don't even go in and pull them all out. Why bother? Many
and
bodies
I
are actually...
Think...
Go ahead.
If I recall, when this topic first came up, they asked John O'Looney, you know, you're in the business, are you seeing this?
Yeah.
And I think his response was no, but it was because he uses a different method for embalming.
Technique, yeah. Yeah.
So
they're there.
I don't
the,
know
the
that
point
we
is
really do know how
grow...
extensive the problem is.
No, we don't. But they can grow anywhere. And... I think that this whole area of clotting is going to be taken by many of you as, oh, my God, yet another area that these weapons are hard at work at, destroying the human biophysiology. Yes, that's true. It's just another area. We're still not in total control of the majority of the information on how these things work.
No, not even close. I mean, we're really at the mercy of time. Just observe and watch how it plays out.
Most of these people are going to be dead, unfortunately, before we acquire that time or complete
that
time.
Well, and it's due to not knowing, number one, the full extent of what's in this thing, these injections, you know, how to treat it. And I do think a lot of information is being withheld.
We know
but,
that
but
from
I'll say
Pfizer
this.
Documents.
Here,
yeah.
I'm not ready to ascribe these clots entirely to the lipid nanoparticle. I do think that there's more at play here. I think much of it has to do with the expression product being the spike and or these junk proteins due to the frame shifting of the reading of the mRNA. Mm-hmm. And the extreme inflammatory response on the part of the body. The blood is thick with what we call acute phase proteins that are produced by the liver to try to deal with this assault. And these things can coagulate and precipitate. You know, fibrinogen is just one of many. You have serum amyloid A, and that is driving amyloidosis in many people. And that's more of a systemic type of amyloidosis. And I still don't hear anybody talking about the role of iron and copper.
No, in not a word.
No. Catalyzing these things. And just for fun, earlier today, I brought up, this is an old, 10 years old, article on the web that a guy named Bill Sardi, S-A-R-D-I, the vitamin supplement answer man, wrote 10 years ago. Do you have that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's right up there.
I've mentioned this before that iron's role in creating these fibrinogen, these resistant clots is not new. It Risia Pretorius, the distinguished professor in South Africa, and her colleague Professor Douglas Kell, have written extensively on this.
Right. This is 2014. Look under our names in Guess. Fibrinoloid clots are not new. Dense iron-copper-induced blood clots linked to brain, eye, and heart diseases. That's the paper, 2014, and you can click on it and download it, read it, whatever you want. It's right there.
Yeah, so it's not new, and we know from COVID that iron is very dysregulated. You might have high ferritin levels, but it's not bound to the iron. That's part of the problem. The iron is floating around freely, causing oxidative stress. Copper appears to be doing the same thing. Maybe doing as much, if not more, damage.
The people that built these bioweapons, they knew this. They knew so much more than the average person will ever even conceive of. This thing is deep, dark, and dirty. It's satanic.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And, the free unbound copper, I think, is contributing to a lot of the bleeding issues, so-called menstrual issues, reproductive issues in women, because copper, a lot of people don't know this, but copper is actually a metalloestrogen, and it can act like estrogen in the body. And at the same time, it can also interfere with the binding of progesterone to its receptor. And when you interfere with the binding of progesterone, you can end up with things like miscarriages. When it's acting like estrogen, it's promoting clotting. And free copper will also interfere with the blood's ability to clot. It interferes with at least two blood clotting factors, acting somewhat like Coumadin. And so free copper is, I think, a major player here. I just would not rule that out. And, the type of menstrual issues that women are having are not responsive to hormones, which
not at all.
Tells
that's
you
kind
something
of thrown,
else is interfering.
Yes, that's confused a lot of people, too. Why not? Why no response? They're missing it. I don't know if this is going to gain any traction, but we're putting it out there, and hopefully it will.
Yeah, so, the fact that it's really nobody's talking about this major dysregulation with both iron and copper is a big deal,
right.
I think.
I agree. I completely agree. Okay, so that's there for you. The paper is up in Guess. You can find it there. The program will be posted as well. You can listen to it again. Share it, and hopefully learn from it. This is, again, rather complicated for the average person. Now, there's nothing wrong with the average person. It's just, it's science. And without science to help us unravel this horrible, destructive weapon, we wouldn't get anywhere. So thankfully, we have that kind of knowledge to deal with. Stephanie Seneff is another name. How mRNA shots, how the bioweapon injections induce brain diseases. This is a very important subject. We do understand, and we've made this point for several years now, that the spike protein will cause your body's normal protein production to go awry. In other words, it'll cause a normal protein to misfold, and it will be useless, except it becomes pathogenic at that point, and if it goes into the brain or any other major organ of the body, it will begin to do damage, okay? And that tipped over normal protein, which is now a prion protein. And here's the rub. Your body makes prion proteins already, and they're fine. You need them. So we call prion proteins brain destroyers, but in reality, the body will make prion proteins that are not misfolded. So the spike will misfold them and other proteins, and they'll go to work destroying the body. So this is what Dr. Seneff is going to talk about a little bit. Anything else?
No, go ahead.
Dr. Stephanie Seneff.
Please kindly explain to us what prions and prion-like diseases are.
Yes, a very, very fascinating disease space for me. I've been very interested in these diseases for a long time, and I'm fascinated with these proteins. It's a protein-based infection, which is quite unusual. As opposed to having an organism that's alive like a virus, you have a protein. It's just a protein that induces a disease and that spreads by virtue of something sort of like crystallization. So when you have these prion proteins, all these different animals have different versions of the prion protein. The human version is the one that causes CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is a terrible neurodegenerative disease, a disease that usually takes you down quite quickly. The protein, prion protein has two different ways to fold, a good way and a bad way. And when it folds in the bad way, it can trigger other prion proteins to also fold in the bad way. It gathers them into these fibrils that then accumulate in the brain as plaque. And so you have plaque builds up all throughout your brain as the disease spreads, and it spreads from one neuron to another via, in many cases, via exosomes, which are really fascinating little lipid particles that are released by cells as a communication network with all the other cells. So when a cell has this overload of this misfolded prion protein, it typically ships it out inside these exosomes, and then it's picked up by other neurons, and so it can spread throughout the brain that way. So it's really a very terrible, terrible situation that is can be provoked by prion-like proteins that are from external sources. So that's what's really, really interesting to me. You can have a protein that comes from some other species that can, in fact, from a virus, that can then trigger misfolding of the initial seed prion protein that then accumulates more, gathers more into these fibrils.
Such as vectored by shedding. Follow? Mm-hmm. If she's talking about other proteins outside the body, she's generally referring here to spike protein. And that's the big part that most people can't understand. Proteins are awfully small, and they'll go right through your skin if you're in contact.
So what did you find specifically with regard to the spike protein in SARS-CoV-2 acting as a prion?
That is the thing I'm very, very worried about. And there have been papers, published papers that have shown that this spike protein has a unique property that is prion-like, and that is distinct from the other coronaviruses. So this is an insertion that was put into this that has appeared in this specific SARS-CoV-2 in the spike protein, that is known to be very very prion-like, that it can cause other proteins to misfold in the same way that other known proteins can do. So that
it tips them right over, basically, and they, in turn, can go on and do the same thing to other innocuous, normal proteins in your body. It's a cascade. So the spike can start it, and it won't stop. That's why, it's one of the reasons we're getting these incredible, what would you call it, a stage whatever, CJD, you're critically ill and you're dead in 5 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 weeks. We're finding people who have CJD that really had no idea they were afflicted. And then they start to show symptoms and they're gone in a month or less, right? Didn't we see one that was even 10 or 11 days or something like that?
Yeah, that was in Luc Montagnier's paper that he documented 26 cases in France, people who had received the vax, and you know, it was rapid onset CJD.
Right, yeah. Okay, we're not talking about turbo cancer. We're really talking about turbo CJD here.
Mm.
And it's pretty grim.
Really, really disturbing. And in fact, a study showed they analyzed theoretically, and they found many regions within the protein that could be prion-like, and one in particular was the strongest one. And then they subjected the prion protein to enzymes that would break it down into component peptides, and they found that there was this one peptide that survived the enzymatic action that was, in fact, exactly the same as the one they had found theoretically to be the worst case prion-like segment that could then trigger prion disease.
So the worst one survived being taken apart by enzymatic activity. Isn't that a coincidence?
How about
that? I hope you all understand the sophistication of this death weapon. They didn't miss a trick. And as we said earlier, we don't even begin to have the whole story. We've got a big piece of it now. But there's so much to this.
And I guess it doesn't matter if this spike protein comes from the natural SARS-CoV-2 or from the vaccine. What's the difference here?
Yeah, so there is a difference, in my opinion. And this has me very, very concerned, because the virus typically comes in through the mucosal barriers, gets into the lungs, stays pretty much in the lungs. If you've got a healthy immune system, you can control it, you can get rid of it, you're done. If you don't have a healthy immune system, it can leak out into the blood vessels and circulate throughout the body. But there's still the vascular barrier, so it has to get past the vascular barrier to get into the tissues. That's two barriers that it has to cross over because your immune system is very impaired. You might have cancer, you might be taking cancer immune suppressing therapy, this kind of thing. So then you can be very vulnerable. And eventually you get, you know, something like long COVID. I think long COVID actually is a consequence of the virus getting into the brain, or especially the spike protein getting into the brain and being taken up by the neurons and then inducing these neurodegenerative diseases. And, you know, the prion protein is just the beginning. There are all these other proteins in the brain that are also susceptible to misfolding. And some of them, they're starting to find out, also misfold in the same way. They can spread the disease in the same way the prion protein can.
There's the cascade right there. So the prion protein starts it, and any misfolded protein can go on to cause other normal, natural, healthy proteins to misfold. It's a cascade. There's no cure for this. Nothing you can do except get your house.
Well, if there is, we haven't seen it yet. Yeah, you know, and Stephanie is. I mean, many people, knowing her skill at doing this research, have written to her, in contact with her, and she has some very, very, you know, tough cases, and you know,
right.
Nothing.
No.
That they've come up with has been able to turn this around.
No, not yet. All right, we'll play another minute or so here.
You've heard of probably amyloid beta, which is associated with Alzheimer's disease, alpha-synuclein, which is associated with Parkinson's disease. There is a whole set of these very fascinating proteins that are very important, actually, to biology. They do very important things to protect the brain from damage, from external exposures to toxins. But if you get too many of them, if they're too over-expressed in a neuron, then they start to coalesce into these misfolded plaques that cause trouble. So it's and what's interesting is that stressors like the spike protein actually induce, upregulate, cause the neurons to make more of this prion protein and also of these prion-like proteins, because they're part of the process of coping with stressors, and the spike protein is a very major stressor. So the neurons see the spike protein, they react to it by upregulating, increasing these proteins that have the potential to misfold, and then those proteins are helping to solve the problem of removing the spike protein, because it can cause DNA damage. You get these DNA double strand breaks. The neuron is responding with an attempt to remove the spike protein. It can do that by digesting it, but it needs these prion-like proteins to digest it. And so it ends up having too many of them, and then that's when it gets into this misfolding situation.
Okay, so, well, we've gone from amyloid clots and their formation and so forth to spike protein-induced protein cascades and leading to CJD. And so far, there's nothing to be done about any of it.
Yeah, once that process is underway...
And these are just two things of this panoply of anti-life procedures and processes that the injection and probably the virus institute inside the body. We're still learning. This is really not a good thing.
At the root of it all, though, is inflammation. You know, the body is upregulating all of
everything.
These protective mechanisms,
yes,
to try to stave it off. But in doing so, it's paying a price.
Truly amazing. All right, let's jump over and do some of our readers. Some of you have been sending some readers in. Thank you for those. We'll try and work them in if we can. We have so much information here, though. So we're going to go to our Chronicles file of anecdotal, yes, in many cases. These are people just reporting, but they have medical data to back it up. But we're just hearing the anecdotal part of it. Go to 17 July. We have six parts. Post-COVID vax ALS. There's six.
Okay.
Got them?
Yep.
All right. Go ahead with the first one. Now, tell everyone what ALS is real quick, just simply.
So, yeah, ALS is a neurodegenerative disease that affects
not
the
CJD.
Motor neuron.
Not CJD. This is different. All right.
It is different. So you typically, it presents with a loss of coordination in the lower limbs. You know, you might have a foot drop. In some cases, it can start above the neck. They call that bulbar ALS, and it tends to progress quite a bit faster because it's closer to the brain. And it ends by paralyzing or, you know, losing the ability to breathe, your respiratory, your diaphragm.
Your musculature is useless. You can't breathe, as she just said, and you die a terrible, awful. It's all awful. It's all awful. I don't care what it is. CJD doesn't matter. This is ALS. All right, go ahead with the first one, please.
Hello. Sorry to post anonymously, but my employer and most of my friends and extended family are not aware of my condition yet, and I need your help. I had fever, chills, and loss of appetite in January 2024. I went for a week without eating and then recovered. Early March, I got sick again, tested positive for COVID, began feeling better, but after about 3 weeks, developed brain fog, and then a weak left leg by end of March. MRI seemed to indicate transverse myelitis, and the EMG was not indicative of ALS. Tested for 3 bands of Lyme, but doctor and infectious disease doctor concluded after more blood work and 2 spinal taps that I did not have Lyme. I was hospitalized from April 22 to the 28th and given high doses of steroids, 2 days of antibiotics, and then plasma infusions, and have been on 50 milligrams of prednisone since April. Condition worsened. And currently I have atrophy and loss of strengthening both legs and both arms and core, numbness in my hands, feet, and jaw, ringing in my ears. I feel like electricity or infection throughout my body and fatigued. I went to the Mayo and think ALS or transverse myelitis and neuropathy. I want to explore Lyme disease more carefully. There are a number of doctors who say they specialize in Lyme disease, but it isn't clear if they do. I went to infectionologist who indicated he understood Lyme disease, but didn't mention any of the specialized testing. Any recommendations on specialized doctors? I'm willing to travel. I saw that the Diana protocol named 2 doctors, but doesn't recommend them. I plan to get the Igenics test. Is there a recommended doctor that works with this test and is familiar with the pretest procedure noted by Diana protocol? Sorry for the long post, and thanks for any help. So one word on that is it is not uncommon after COVID, a bad case of COVID, to suddenly test positive for Lyme disease. And there is compelling evidence to believe that Lyme is actually, or ALS, some forms of ALS, have their roots in Lyme disease. And if you can get at the Lyme infection and eradicate it, quite often you will recover from so-called ALS, if it isn't, you know, truly ALS, genetically driven. And people have recovered that way. There are people that do recover from ALS, either because it was not diagnosed
early enough,
you know, accurately in the beginning, or there have been, you know, spontaneous recoveries. And I mentioned that Nell DeBus, who wrote the book Can You Walk Yet, she recovered from ALS, confirmed diagnosis, met all the classical diagnostic criteria for ALS, and she did recover on her own. She had been going to an energy healer.
Right. Very good. Okay. Next one. Hi, everyone. I just have a question. How many of you experienced ALS-type symptoms after their COVID vaccine? My mom never had any health issues, and after she got the COVID shot, she got ALS. I am so upset about this. I wish she never had taken the shot. I will never trust in a vaccine ever again. And in response to that, I had no problems after the Pfizer COVID shots. They did kick up the Lyme a bit. There's that Lyme factor. But I took Andrographis to knock it down. I think vaccines could trigger Lyme to get worse sometimes, but it's likely because your immune system is compromised. I got ALS symptoms after taking radioactive barium for a swallow test. Bad mistake. Had to do a month of chelation therapy. You need to have your heavy metals, those levels, checked. Heavy metals can participate in muscular dysfunction. Barium alone can cause potassium imbalance that the Lyme will thrive off of. My legs were going batshit crazy with spasms and twitching. That's all gone because of chelation therapy now. And don't forget about barium, friends, because barium is one of the primary components in chemtrails. Mm. Another comment here. Go ahead and finish the next two.
Someone says, thank you for this comment and sharing. I am interested in chelation therapy. What is this and where do you get it? I think I have heavy metals from IV contrast over and over. And he replies, chelation usually involves taking one or two medications like DMSA, alpha-lipoic acid, calcium EDTA, and others. Chelation therapy must be done carefully and with a plan. Very true.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. Okay, there are more, but it's pretty thick down there. So we'll kind of draw to a conclusion there. Just to remind you again that shedding is real. Be careful. Don't be embarrassed or afraid to wear a mask. Don't worry if people look at you and think that you're bowing down to some government paranoia. You are not. You are taking competent care of yourself when you are in an environment where spike protein is being, and maybe LNP, and according to Dr. Stephanie Seneff, the mRNA, they're being shed in any location where vaxxed people are living and breathing. So don't be embarrassed. Don't be ashamed. We urge you to wear the mask in any kind of a store setting where you're forced to be around other people. I personally, we both wear gloves if we go into a market, a little lightweight gloves that no one even notices. It's not paranoia. It's predicated on science. As we continue to unravel this death weapon, we have to keep ourselves, as many of us as possible, alive and healthy. That's the whole thing. And guarding against shedding is one of the best things you can do. Even if you're vaxxed.
Yeah, there's all kinds of bacterial infections and other viruses that are being spread right now. I mean, measles is one. The shingles, it's still out there. And you know, you can pick that up by touch.
That's all it takes. There are also ongoing efforts to push this bird flu plandemic. We don't know if they're going to go through with the whole thing and really roll it out, or they might switch off to something else. UK health officials today declared a level 4 bird flu outbreak after the virus jumped from cows to humans. So we've all seen the game and how they play it, and they own the media. And they own the health agencies, they own the governments, and they own big pharma. And I mean they, it's that same basic group of people running the planet. No doubt about it. All right, that's going to wrap it up. Anything you want to add here? We've covered a lot of ground, and I hope it wasn't too much for all of you, but there's a lot of ground to be covered with this stuff. It's just awful.
No, that's plenty. Lots to think about, but Yeah, you know, it's biowarfare, and you have to just be cognizant of that.
And literally, virtually, most everyone out there that you encounter should be viewed as a potential walking bioweapon because of shedding.
Yeah. Yeah, the people that continue to take these shots, and don't forget, come September, there's going to be another one, another
COVID
shot.
The new model year is coming in September, along with automobiles. That's when they usually roll them out.
And I believe the Moderna mRNA for RSV is, it's been approved, and I'm not sure if it's being distributed yet, but it is approved, so...
More talk about
that one will shed as well.
Yes. More talk about forced COVID vaccines. And I'm using the term advisedly, as you know. More talk about forced shots.